Okay, I want you to just look around you for a second. Pick any object made of metal, you know, the frame of your car, maybe a bridge you're driving over. To the naked eye, it looks
Yeah.
solid. Uniform? It's just gray stuff.
Well, you'd hope so. Especially the bridge.
Fair point.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. If we could zoom in, I mean, way in,
Yeah.
past the paint, past the microscopic grains, all the way down to the atoms themselves, it's not a solid block of gray at all, is it? It's a whole universe.
It's an incredibly chaotic and dynamic world down there, yeah. And, you know, it's really the only place we can solve some of the biggest mysteries in material science.
And that's exactly where we're going today. We're doing a deep dive into that atomic underworld. We're going to try and solve a kind of detective story about a steel structure called bainite.
Ah, bainite.
Yeah.
It's been the focus of what you could almost call a metallurgical civil war for like
The
decades
Civil War.
over how steel forms.
Mars.
Oh, absolutely. The whole fight is about the mechanism. Does it grow slowly with atoms kind of wandering around? Or does it just snap into place, you know, like a line of soldiers marching in perfect lockstep?
Wanderers versus soldiers. I love
Sure.
that. And to crack this case, we're looking at a pretty famous paper by HKD Chipadasia and A.R. Wall.
Right.
The title is a bit of a mouthful, Bainite, an atom probe study of the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
It's a classic. And it's a classic because of the tool they used. They didn't just guess. They used something called an imaging atom probe.
Which sounds like it's straight out of science fiction.
It's pretty close. It essentially lets you dismantle a piece of steel, one single atom at a time. You get to see exactly where every atom was standing when the music stopped.
Okay, so we are going subatomic.
Let's do it.
So before we get into the atomic drama, we have to talk about this machine. Because I think when people hear microscope, they're picturing a lens, you know?
Right, something you squint into.
Exactly. But that's not what this is at all.
Not even close. I mean, an optical microscope uses light, an electron microscope uses electrons. But even they have trouble telling you precisely what element is at what coordinate. The atom probe is, well, it's a hybrid. It's a field ion microscope combined with a time of flight mass spectrometer.
Okay, time of flight mass spectrometer. Break that
Yeah.
down. How do you weigh an atom by timing it?
It's an amazing setup, actually. You start with your sample, a tiny, tiny needle of steel, and you sharpen it to an unbelievably fine point, maybe 100 nanometers.
Wow.
Then you cool it way down, I mean, cryogenic temperatures with solid nitrogen,
So you're literally freezing the scene of the crime.
freezing it solid. Then you use a little bit of neon gas for imaging to see
Yeah.
the surface. And then comes the violent part.
Uh-oh.
You hit that needle with these incredibly powerful electric pulses.
You zap it.
You zap it, and the electric field at that tiny tip is so intense, it just rips atoms off the surface, one by one.
And that's the time of flight that they get ripped off.
That's it. See, heavy atoms move slower than light atoms, right? Given the same push. So by measuring to the nanosecond how long it takes for that atom to fly down a tube and hit a detector, you know exactly what element it is.
So if it's a slow poke, it's a heavy manganese atom. If it's super fast, it's a tiny little carbon atom.
Precisely. And you know where on the tip it came from? So you can build this perfect 3D map, atom by
So
atom.
I saw a note in the source material, something called Principles of Objective Atom Probe Analysis. It had this really stern warning. It said, you have to discuss the science without exaggerating
Right.
or using superlatives.
Yeah, that's a really important rule in this field because the images you get, they look like star charts. They're beautiful.
I can
And
imagine.
it's so easy to see a little cluster of dots and shout, look, a pattern. When it might just be random noise. So Padeshia and Waugh, they're all about quantitative proof, not pretty pictures. They want hard numbers.
Show me the math, not the art. All right, so let's get to the victim in our story, the steel itself. They didn't just use any old piece of metal, right? They had a specific recipe.
Oh, yeah, the composition is absolutely critical. It's an iron alloy with about 0.43% carbon, 3% manganese, and 2.02% silicon.
2% silicon. That sounds like a lot. Isn't it usually just a tiny additive?
It is. But in this case, it's the secret weapon. It's what we call the silicon trick.
The silicon trick? I like the sound of that. What does it do?
Well, to get the trick, you have to understand the problem. Mm-hmm. Normally, when bainite forms, this other compound, cementite, precipitates out almost instantly.
And cementite is just iron and carbon.
Just iron and carbon bonded together. And the problem is it forms so fast that it gobbles up all the nearby carbon.
It eats the evidence.
It completely destroys the timeline. If you want to know where the carbon was during their reaction, you can't have it all getting locked away in cementite right at the start.
So that's where the silicon comes in.
Right. Silicon, for chemical reasons, hates cementite. It actively suppresses it. So by adding 2% silicon, the researchers basically hit the pause button on that precipitation.
Ah, so they force the carbon to stay out in the open where they can track it?
That's it. It lets them see the direct interaction between the parent metal, the austenite, and the new structure, the bainitic ferrite, without all that other interference.
Okay, so we've got the machine that sees atoms. We've got the alloy that preserves the evidence. Now let's get to the fight, this controversy. Wanderers versus soldiers.
This is really the heart of the whole debate. How does austenite actually turn into bainite?
Let's start with the wanderers. That's the diffusion theory.
Correct. The diffusion-controlled theory. Think of it like a crowded room. In this model, every single atom moves individually. They shuffle around, they weave through the crowd, they find new places. It's all very random.
So it's a slow, uncoordinated process.
Exactly. And if that's true, all the atoms, the iron, the manganese, the silicon, they should all get mixed up and redistributed.
Okay. And the soldiers. The displacive theory.
That's the Martin Siddick model. And here, it's not a crowd, it's a military formation. When the command is given, the entire block of atoms shifts together in a coordinated shear movement.
So they don't change neighbors. The whole crystal lattice just snaps into a new configuration.
That's the idea. And the critical part is, if it's a coordinated snap like that, the big heavy atoms like manganese and silicon, they just don't have time to move.
They get trapped where they are.
They're frozen in place. It's what we call a diffusionless transformation, at least for those substitutional atoms.
So the mission for our detectives is pretty simple then. Look at the boundary between the old and new structures. If the manganese and silicon atoms are all bunched up in new places, it was a shuffle. But if they're still in their original random positions, it was a snap.
That's the test, exactly.
So they fired up the atom probe. They started zapping atoms. What did they find?
The results were, they were completely unambiguous. They found zero, statistically zero, redistribution of manganese or silicon across that interface.
Zero. They didn't move at all.
A flat line. The concentration inside the new bainite was exactly the same as in the parent austenite. They were trapped.
Wow. Okay, so that sounds like case closed, right?
It's the strongest possible evidence you could ask for.
If the big atoms didn't wander, it had to be the military snap. It has to be Martin Siddick.
The soldiers definitely marched.
But I'm sensing a but is coming.
There's always a but.
The carbon.
The carbon. Right. See, manganese and silicon are big. They replace iron atoms in the lattice. But carbon is tiny. It's an interstitial. It lives in the gaps between the iron atoms.
So it can move a lot faster.
Much, much faster. And the atom probe data showed that the carbon absolutely did move. The distribution was all over the place.
Hang on. If the carbon moved, doesn't that support the wanderer theory? I thought the whole point of the soldier theory was that nobody moves.
And that's where the nuance comes in. And it's why this tool was so critical. The data showed something really specific. Inside the new bainite, there was still a lot of carbon. But there was less carbon than in the parent austenite it grew from.
So it shed some carbon during the process?
It did. But, and this is a huge but, it still had way, way more carbon than it should have if it were at equilibrium. It was super saturated.
Meaning it was stuffed with more carbon than it was comfortable holding.
Precisely.
Right.
And then if you looked just outside the bainite in the austenite that was left over, you saw these huge spikes in carbon concentration.
It was like the bainite formed and then immediately kicked all the extra carbon out the door.
That is the perfect analogy. You can see it in the data. They call them carbon piles. Just clouds of carbon atoms piled up right at the boundary.
So that's the million-dollar question. Did the carbon leave during the growth or after the growth?
And this is the pivot point of the paper. To answer that, we have to talk about the incomplete reaction phenomenon.
The incomplete reaction sounds like something you get on a report card.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. But it's this fundamental property of bainite formation. You cool the steel down, the austenite starts turning into bainite. And then, for no obvious reason, it just stops.
It runs out of stuff to transform.
No, that's the bizarre part. There's tons of austenite left, but the reaction just halts. It goes on strike.
Why would it do that?
The study confirmed what many had suspected. The reaction stops at a very specific point. It stops when the carbon content in the leftover austenite hits a thermodynamic limit called the T-Dollower curve.
Okay, we need to decode some of this alphabet soup.
Yeah.
The paper mentions the T-Dollower curve versus something called the A3-Dollower curve.
Right. Think of them as two different finish lines in a race.
Okay.
The A3-Dollower curve, that's the true finish line. That's full equilibrium. That's where all the atoms would end up if you gave them infinite time. They're all comfortable, low energy.
The happy place for atoms.
The happy place. But the T-Dollower curve is more like an energy wall you hit. It's the point where the parent austenite and the new ferrite have the exact same free energy. There's no energy profit in transforming anymore.
There's no advantage to switching sides.
Not for a displacive shear transformation, no. In fact, if the carbon gets any higher than that T-Dollower line, the austenite actually becomes more stable. The reaction becomes impossible.
So, let me see if I've got this. If it were a simple diffusion process, the Wanderers, they would just keep shuffling along until they hit that final A3-Dollower finish line.
Correct. Nothing would stop them.
But the fact that the reaction slams to a halt at the T-Dollower energy wall,
yeah,
that proves it's not a wandering process. It proves it's the snap.
It proves that the growth mechanism is limited by the driving force needed for that shear transformation. As carbon gets pushed out and piles up in the austenite, that driving force gets smaller and smaller. Once you hit T-Dollower's, the tank is empty. The soldiers simply can't march anymore.
So let's put it all together. The verdict? Heavy atoms didn't move. Check. That proves the snap.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction stops the energy limit, T-Dollower, not the equilibrium limit. Check. That also proves the snap.
The growth itself is diffusionless. Mm.
But I'm still stuck on the carbon piles. If the growth is a snap, why is there carbon piled up outside?
This is their brilliant two-step narrative. It fits every single piece of evidence. Step one, a bainite plate grows incredibly fast, martensitically, a snap. And in that exact microsecond, it inherits all the carbon from its parent. It's fully supersaturated.
So for a split second, it's holding way too much carbon.
It is. But this is all happening at a few hundred degrees Celsius, which is hot enough for carbon to be mobile. So step two, immediately after that plate forms, the carbon atoms realize they're in a very crowded room. They panic, and they diffuse out of the new bainite and into the surrounding austenite.
Ah, so the diffusion happens, but only after the growth event is already over.
Exactly. Previous researchers couldn't separate those two events. They happened too close together. They just saw the end result, the carbon piles.
But the atom probe, by showing the reaction stopped at that T-Dollower limit, proved that the growth itself had to be the snap.
And that explains the incomplete reaction. Each new plate of bainite forms dumps its carbon trash into the hallway. The hallway gets more and more crowded with carbon until finally it's so full it hits the T-Dollower limit that no new plates can form. The reaction chokes itself off.
So the incompleteness is literally the reaction drowning in its own exhaust.
A very good way of putting it. And this creates a very specific visual structure that they saw in the atom probe. These sheaves of bainite, like a sheaf of wheat. Little platelets of bainite separated by thin films of that carbon-enriched austenite.
Those films are the trash piles.
Those films are the trash piles that stop the reaction.
That's just, it's so satisfying to see a huge debate settled just by being able to look a little bit closer.
It really is. It connects the thermodynamics to the actual structure you can see.
So the final verdict is that bainite is a hybrid. It grows like a soldier, but then it immediately relaxes like a civilian, pushing out the carbon it doesn't want.
That's a great summary. And, you know, understanding that hybrid nature is absolutely critical for why these steels are so useful in the real world.
That was my next question. Why should we care? Why do we want an incomplete steel? That sounds flawed.
Because that incompleteness is the key. Remember those thin films of carbon-rich austenite left behind?
The stuff that stopped the reaction.
Yes. Well, austenite is tough and ductile. It's like a shock absorber. It can bend and deform without breaking.
Okay.
The bainite itself, on the other hand, is very hard and very strong. So if you can design a steel where you precisely control how much of that ductile austenite is left over.
By controlling that T-Dollower limit.
By controlling that limit, you create a natural composite material. You get the incredible strength of the bainite plus the toughness and damage resistance of the austenite.
So by stopping the reaction early, by making it intentionally incomplete, you actually create a better, tougher material.
Exactly right. If you let it go all the way to perfection to the A3-Dollower finish line, you'd probably end up with a much more brittle steel. The incomplete state is the sweet spot.
That's a fascinating idea. We think of incomplete as a failure. But here, stopping before you get to the end is the entire point.
It really is. It's the basis for some of the most advanced high-strength steels we have today.
Like the trip steels you hear about in cars. Transformation-induced plasticity.
That's them. The steels they use in modern car safety cages. That retained austenite absorbs the energy from a crash so you don't. And that technology exists because of fundamental work like this.
So next time you see a modern car, you can thank the silicon trick and a bunch of carbon atoms getting shoved out into the hallway.
And the scientists who spent years zapping needles of steel to figure it all out.
Well, that just about wraps up our deep dive into the case of the incomplete reaction. It's a story of soldiers, wanderers, and a job perfectly left half done.
And a good reminder that the most solid-looking things around us are just buzzing with activity on the inside.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening.
Take care.